Dream Lover, take five.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. 'Cause I need a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
On December 20th, 1973, singer Bobby Darin died following his second open-heart surgery. He was 37 years old. In his short life, he wrote 163 songs, recorded 486, played in 14 films, and was nominated for an Academy Award as Best Supporting Actor. Darin is also in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and is best known for his hits Splish Splash, Dream Lover, Mac the Knife, and Beyond the Sea. This month, a new biopic of the singer called Beyond the Sea opens. It stars Kevin Spacey as Bobby Darin. Spacey, who has two Oscars himself, also wrote, co-produced, and directed the film. But unlike Ray, the film of Ray Charles, where star Jamie Foxx lip-syncs to Ray Charles' recordings, in Beyond the Sea, Bobby Darin's songs are sung by Kevin Spacey.
Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me, my lover stands on golden sands and watches the ships that go sailing.
Kevin Spacey is in our studio. Welcome. What a pleasure it is to meet you.
Thank you for having me.
Was there any doubt at all whether you would actually sing Darin songs?
There wasn't in my mind at all, and it's for a couple of reasons. I grew up loving and watching and admiring the great MGM musicals, and I knew that was Fred Astaire, and that was Gene Kelly, and that was Donald O'Connor, and I always, you know, admired the talents of those kind of artists who kind of did it all. Because I started out as a singer doing musicals when I was young, and although it's not the thing that audiences have known me for, I felt that the only way that I could capture the kind of electricity and the kind of energy and style and attack that Bobby had, and the only real, you know, hump to get over was to get the family over their initial reluctance to allow me to sing. And their responsibility is to protect Bobby's legacy. And although they had heard that I wanted to sing the performance in a couple of interviews that I had done, they hadn't yet met me. I had made a pretty conscious decision in the year 2000 when I got the rights that I wasn't going to approach the Darin family until the movie was real. And this isn't just a widget or another project for them. This is about the man that they loved. And I didn't want to put them through another second of dashed hope, because I knew when I bought the rights in 2000, I also bought the film's reputation. And at that point, it was a movie that couldn't get made and nobody wanted to make it. And, you know, how many people knew who Bobby Darin was? You know, all of the negatives were at that point stronger than the positives. And it wasn't until 2003, just as I got the money together, that I reached out to the family, met Steve Blauner, met Dodd Darin, who is Bobby and Sandra Dee's son, and was able to talk from my heart about how much I wanted to honor this man and that I didn't want to do anything that would dissipate his legacy. In terms of the music, if that weren't right, if we couldn't get that right, then it didn't matter what else we did get right in the film. So if people see the movie or hear the soundtrack and it sounds authentic to the original recordings, it's because we were laying down note for note what Bobby had done.
You said in interviews that you used to sing in front of the mirror. I think there's not a person of our generation that hasn't done that. Singing songs.
That's just like accepting an Academy Award, you know.
Yes.
Everybody, or as I used to when I was a young kid, I used to be introduced by Johnny Carson and come out of my curtains, you know, on The Tonight Show, which, by the way, I finally actually got to do once. I had done a TV movie where Johnny Carson had me as a guest, and it was before he retired. So, you know, fantasies do come true.
They do come true. You sang Bobby Darin songs in front of the mirror?
Absolutely, and Sinatra and, you know, Satchmo. And, you know, I was the kid who always did voices and loved to imitate. So I grew up in a house where that kind of brass, that kind of music, Ella Fitzgerald, Sinatra. I mean, a huge Sinatra collection, and my mother loved Bobby Darin. So there was a big Bobby Darin collection, and she pretty much converted me by the time I was 12 or 15 that Bobby was the coolest cat that ever walked the face of the earth.
When you went into the studio to do these recordings and you had his arrangements, did you find yourself imitating the recordings? In other words, it seems there's almost a musical Tourette's that was going on at that period where, you know, it's hey, ho, and you do it yourself, or you know, you have this thing, to get that delivery down.
There was an interesting process. You know, I started working on the music back in 1999, actually even before, just before I got the rights. It looked like I was going to get the rights. And I have to say my thanks to Alan Horn, who runs Warner Brothers. But I started working with a man named Roger Kellaway. We started working and sort of piling through Bobby's catalog. You know, as you mentioned, he performed well over 400 songs that he recorded. So I was going through, you know, and trying to narrow down the selection of songs that I mean, there were certain obvious ones that you knew had to be in the movie. But I wanted to try to give a wider swath of his musical journey and the different genres that he hit. So we just began to work and work and work. And then about 2.5 years later, I brought on Phil Ramone, his legendary record producer, and has done a remarkable job for us. He took me into the studio. So I was recording back, you know, 4 years ago at Capitol Records with a 16-piece orchestra just for rehearsal. I mean, these aren't tracks anyone will ever hear because I listen to them now, and they're not very good. But that's where I was at the time. Phil says that at some point in this process, I stopped trying to do an imitation of Bobby. But by that point, I had watched so much of him. So much of him had percolated into my system that I was doing a version of Bobby, but at the same time, I was using my own instincts as a performer. I was trusting those. And Phil says that when I started to do that, the register in my voice lowered. I became more relaxed. I started hitting the notes better. And I started to, as Phil likes to say, get into the pocket of the music, which is when you're recording live with a band, you're not doing your vocals later, because we didn't. We did all of this live. There is a place you have to sit in the music. And I'll have to say, you know, in all the years of prep, it never got better for me than those 12 days at Abbey Road when we laid down these tracks.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. That's all.
I also have to say, we would play an original Bobby track for the whole orchestra, so that John Wilson and his guys, and in some cases when the orchestra was, I think, up towards 73 pieces, including strings, this band just rose to the occasion and were so determined to capture the authenticity and the accuracy of the sound that I know they raised the level of my game. I mean, I was so determined, you know, also because when the pressure's on and, you know, you've only got so many hours and so much money to get it done, it was more fun than I think I've ever had in my entire life, standing in the middle of that incredibly legendary studio where the Beatles laid down 178 songs. I never wanted to feel shackled by having to do a slavish imitation. It had to come from me, or I think it would have been hollow. So we've tried to get close. But the truth is, to misquote Senator Benson, I'm no Bobby Darin. I knew Bobby Darin, and you're no Bobby Darin. We've tried to get close, but nobody gets that close. And we hope that what we managed to do is to honor him and hopefully turn the spotlight back onto him, because that's the whole purpose.
Oh, the shark, baby, has such teeth, dear, and he shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Mackie Heath, babe, and he keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with his teeth, babe, scarlet below stops. But fancy gloves, though,
where's old Maggie Heath? Maybe. So there's never, never a trace of red. I let them things swing on a sidewalk.
At the very beginning of the movie, I mean, first of all, we hear the finger snaps, which is just so identifies Bobby Darin. And we hear Mac the Knife and John Goodman, who plays Steve Blauner, the best friend and the manager. And he says, boy, that's brave, starting the movie with Mac the Knife. 9 weeks at number one for Darin. Pretty brave for you, too, to start with Mac the Knife.
Well, I was determined to make a kind of unconventional biopic where we kind of broke a lot of the rules. And we do in the course of the film. It's not a conventional film at all. It is it's almost more of a fantasy, in which we use Bobby Darin's life as the centerpiece for this. But we allow ourselves to go to places that movies like this don't generally go into. And one of the things I said was, look, you know, we can either build up to Mac the Knife, you know, and sort of take a long time getting there, or we can just out of the gate say, here it is, we're doing it. Yes, you know. Like it, don't like it, but here's where we're starting.
Jimmy Diver, ho, 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 Suki Tawdry. Hello, Miss Lottie Linya. Good evening, Lucy Brown. Oh, the line forms way on the right bay. And now that Mackie's back in old L.A. town. I say, Jimmy Diver, look out, Suki Tawdry. Stay back, Lottie Linya. Move it over, Lucy Brown. Oh, the line forms way on the right, babe. And now that Mackie's back in town.
What was the key which unlocked the character of Bobby Darin for you to go beyond doing an impression of him to what you've called his essence?
I think he came alive on stage in a way that he never came alive off stage. And, you know, while that may be tragic, you know, to some people, you know, well, what about his family and what about his children? And, well, it's true. He loved Dodd and he loved Sandy greatly, even though it was a difficult marriage. But I think that there are some people for whom performing is their life. And I think it's what kept him alive. You know, he had rheumatic fever, which ravaged him from about the ages of 8 to 12. And this damaged his heart. And it's modern medications that kept him alive. He had to take sulfates every day, injections every day. He was on oxygen a great deal of the time. And yet nobody in his audience would know he had a hangnail. I think there is something about that determination to give your all, to make sure an audience that was coming in was getting your best. And he demanded the best of himself and of everybody around him. I think that's why his reputation as being arrogant, I think, was misinterpreted often, because I just don't think people knew this was a guy who was living on borrowed time and knew it. He's just unbelievable. He does it all.
So you could identify with this person that really does give his all as a performer in
yes,
many ways.
And I think now I understand and appreciate more than ever the dilemma that Bobby faced, that I have faced and that other artists face, which is that conflict between professional expectations and personal freedom. And, you know, look, let's face it. A lot of people in the entertainment world find their niche and just keep circling the same, you know, piece of a floorboard because it's safe, because it's easy, and because they make money. It's never been interesting to me. That would be like having the same breakfast every day. So I have challenged myself by doing roles and taken on projects that, you know, stretched me, asked more of me. And it's interesting how you come under criticism for that. I mean, the last sort of four movies I've done, I've come under such kind of vicious attack in a kind of almost, how dare you try that? Who do you think you are? And I think, well, I'm an actor. That's what I'm supposed to do. And I think that I appreciate now Bobby following his heart, despite what any critic might have thought or even the fact that sometimes audiences rejected him, you know, it's your journey. And you either follow your heart or you follow somebody else's, or you make career moves because you think that's what you should do. So I appreciate that probably now about Bobby more than I ever did, certainly more than when I started this project.
Kevin Spacey is the star, writer, co-producer, and director of Beyond the Sea, a movie about the life of singer Bobby Darin. It opens later this month. He's also artistic director of the Old Vic Theatre in London. Thanks for coming in, and good luck with this.
Thank you so much.
There's more of the interview with Kevin Spacey at our website, npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen.
Dusty walls, people say I was made for this. Nothing else would I trade for this. And just think, I get paid.